Welcome back to our deep dive with Thomas Worthlin McConkie, mindfulness teacher and researcher in the field of adult development. In this episode, we talk about things like where Jesus and prayer went during his adventures in Buddhism. We also explore the increasing role imagination and creativity play as we move through stages of development.
So I do see creativity is potentiated by development. The more we develop, the more mature we are, the more creative we become. That's a really profound dimension of the developmental journey. And I think, you know, Mormonism, we could see a renaissance coming here where creativity is consciously held as a high value.
Yeah.
And I think that would correspond to the later stages that are already starting to come online in our church.
Join us for this fifth episode in our deep dive with Thomas McConkie. We are back here with Thomas McConkie. This is Bill Turnbull from Faith Matters. And so we talked last time more than we had planned a little bit on how the how development, how waking up and growing up relates to how we do things in Mormon culture and Mormon practice in the Mormon church. And I want to get back to that because there's some really interesting questions to ask about that. But I want to talk a little bit, zoom back in a little bit on a personal level.
Yeah.
And talk about, I think I'm curious about a couple of things. First of all, everything that we're talking about assumes that people want to grow. Mm-hmm. And is there such a thing as a person who just wants to chill and just want to do what they want to do no matter what and take kind of that glide path in life and never even get to this achiever stage, but just sort of follow whatever their instincts are telling them to do, let's say the biological instincts.
It's a good question. I think part of it depends.
Are you being too idealistic is what I'm saying?
When I talk about growth, I just mean like that certain something, that certain area, that certain quality in your life that is irresistible. Because it just feels good. It feels expansive. It feels creative. It feels exciting. And we all have that experience. For the scope of our conversation, I'm saying that there is that element of development, and we do seem to be naturally drawn to it.
Yeah. What about the adolescent who seems to be a perpetual adolescent, for whom hedonism seems to sort of get stuck?
Right.
Sometimes in addictions, but other times just in kind of aimless hedonistic behavior. You know, if you look around you in the world, that's a fairly typical post-adolescent or late adolescent and post-adolescent phase of early adulthood. That
this is a complex topic, as you.
Maybe too complex.
Well, we can touch on it. I mean, I think we can say a lot of meaningful things about it. As you ask the question, it occurs to me that on some level, I feel comfortable saying that human beings, if given the opportunity, they'll want to move towards greater agency, greater expression, greater, can we say, mastery of their environment. More profound meaning in life. Mm-hmm. They'll move towards those things. Developmental arrest is real. Adolescence is a particularly vulnerable stage where, you know, we're not quite at the achiever stage yet. When people get to the achiever stage, they're pretty pedal to the metal. They know what they want. They're clear. They're going to throw everything they've got at this goal. You know, I want to make my first million by the time I'm 35. I want to be the first, you know, female in my family to graduate college. I mean, whatever the goal is.
Or I want to be a seminary teacher for the rest of my life.
Anything that ambitious.
Yeah,
it's consistent with your worldview. Yeah, you just, you know, I wanted to be a, you know, proficient meditator.
Yeah.
We go after it. But at the expert phase, depending on a lot of different dynamics in our environment, early childhood traumas, key relationships, things like that, we might get hung up on a lot of early life pain, and we might not quite kick into that higher gear. Statistically, a lot of adults don't reach the achiever stage. It's significant. As many as 30% of adults won't quite ever kick into that high octane, I'm going to grab the world by its horns energy.
Yeah.
And when we're, you know, let's say post-adolescence in the expert phase, from an achiever point of view, the expert can look like they're stagnating. Like, why don't you just find what you love and do something? Why don't you apply yourself? So part of the complexity of this topic is, you know, from what perspective are we taking the are we taking this perspective that that person is just hedonistic and seeking pleasure and not doing what they ought to be doing with their life? Because really, this iterates again at this individualist stage that comes after expert. You know, I've worked with a lot of high power kind of corporate career types where they exhaust the achiever stage. They wear it out. They get as much worldly success as they could have ever imagined, and they still feel empty. So they kick into this kind of laid back, I'm just going to surf, or I'm just going to, like, you know, I'm going to just spend my day at the park with my dogs, with my kids, whatever it is. And that can seem very unambitious to the achiever as well. So I think pathology, I think trauma, I think all of those things play in. Sometimes we're in so much pain that we don't have enough bandwidth to pursue our higher meaning. But I haven't ever experienced a human being that doesn't instinctively move towards higher meaning. That's what I would say about it. And there's a lot more to say about it.
You have identified two generational problems. One is quite obvious to many of us, and that's young people who never get to that achiever stage, but suffer through anxiety or depression, and it's disabling and it's developmental arrest for sure.
Absolutely.
I can see, I just thought yesterday, I had an encounter with a person, I thought they're in middle life, and definitely stuck in that sort of expert expert phase because it feels just safe to them and they can make sense of the world that way and they don't want to really get past it. But there are a lot of people in my age group who, you're right, go through, fully live out that achiever stage and then like, I'm done. I think I've done what I'm supposed to do and it's time to play golf. And but all of those periods, those usher in periods of in your life, dry, arid periods that at some point aren't satisfying and you feel like, I agree with you that there's something deep within us that just wants to grow.
Yeah. I love your description there, like the dry, arid periods. I think those are unavoidable in a sense. Developmentally, like there is a point in our life where something is incredibly meaningful. All we want to do is give ourselves to it fully. And then we wear it out. I mean, we really wear these stages out. And once we wear it out, it's like, okay, I'm in the desert.
Well, partly
I don't know what my life means anymore.
Partly it's because we don't have a framework to see beyond, or the imagination to see beyond where our upbringing or society tells us, maybe we've arrived.
I think that's true, and that's a context-aware view that you just took. I mean, we grow up in this phrase, like, think out of the box. That's actually, I mean, arguably, that comes from a individualist consciousness. It says, like, look, the box in Utah, we're in Utah here, KSL Studios. Mm-hmm. We're in Utah, and the box is, you know, you go on a mission, and you get married, and you have kids, and you be a lawyer, doctor, dentist if you're a man, and if you're a woman, you know, you should have at least two more kids than you had. However many you had, have two more. You know, so there's that box, and then context-aware consciousness comes along. It's like, dude, like, you get out of that box, and you're out of the cave, and your imagination just swells. There's so many possibilities that your culture, that your upbringing didn't make apparent to you.
Yeah. How do we do in cultivating in our culture, let's say in Mormon culture, those qualities of imagination and creativity that would serve us so well when we get stuck?
You know, so I'm married to an artist.
Yeah.
And she's quite a talented artist at that. And
she's great.
And she, thank you. And she was raised LDS, returned missionary, all that stuff. And, you know, she often laments at how, can I say, without putting words in her mouth, how mediocre our aesthetic development in Mormonism is. Like, she'll look at a church building and just be like, seriously? Mm. We can't do better than that? Mm. You know, like, not as a criticism, as a, I think she loves the church so much and she's so good at producing beauty that she just says, like, why don't we care more about beauty? I'm just tapping into like an example of someone with incredible aesthetic intelligence. Aesthetics is its own line of development, just like cognition, just like emotion. And, you know, in that sense, I don't know how much we value aesthetic intelligence in Mormonism and so forth. And, you know, to me, again, it's an opportunity to notice more dimensions of development and ask ourselves the question, hey, could we be doing better in that area? So I think I relate aesthetics to imagination and creativity, but I also think there's a certain element when we're talking about a Mormon culture that to date, I think this is changing. I think it's evolving and I think it's exciting. But to date, when the value system is expressed so much through the diplomat stage, through the expert stage of, look, this is what it is, this is it, it's true, keep doing it. Bold, out of the box, innovation, that kind of stuff. Like, we're less concerned with that at these stages than just kind of sticking with the program. So I do see creativity is potentiated by development. The more we develop, the more mature we are, the more creative we become. That's a really profound dimension of the developmental journey. And I think, you know, Mormonism, we could see a renaissance coming here where creativity is consciously held as a high value.
Yeah.
And I think that would correspond to the later stages that are already starting to come online in our church.
Yeah. And you talk about the aesthetic element of creativity and imagination. Mm-hmm. That's probably maybe the most obvious way that comes to mind. There's also, but there's like you said, there's so many other ways that can manifest. We don't have a lot of Nobel Prize winners you know, in Mormonism. We don't have a lot of tell me of a great Mormon theoretical physicist, for example. There's a realm in which imagination and creativity are essential to making breakthroughs.
It's interesting. You hear about the Dalai Lama's training. You know, he's a Tibetan Buddhist, and there's a rich tradition of very rigorous training of the rational mind within this school of Buddhism. My experience is that we don't highly value training Latter-day Saints to be sharp, incisive, critical thinkers. And critical thinking is another form of creativity.
Yeah.
We can see something, deeply question the way it is, and imagine it being better. That, in a sense, that's what a criticism is. Wouldn't it be great to see a Tibetan-style school pop up in Salt Lake County?
Yeah, it's really, it's interesting the way that the Dalai Lama engaged from his spiritual background, engaged science, and basically brought, I think, a new perspective.
Right.
To, so,
no question that was a product in part of his training, you know, in the Tibetan school, where the rational mind is really treated as this muscle, this gift that we need to develop. And it was intuitive for the Dalai Lama to say, look, Western science, this is a part of the fruition of our tradition. We have to learn to embrace it.
Yeah. And this is that meeting of East and West, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. It's so fascinating.
Yeah.
But, okay, so I want to get back now to your personal story and talk about what we teased about in our last session, which is, so where did Jesus go in this whole process?
Yeah. So I love Jesus. I love all things Jesus. I love to talk about Jesus. So this is like this is the best an interview can be in my world. There's a developmental framework that's really interesting. Actually, I'm going to tell the story first, then I'm going to come back to it. When I was younger, Jesus was just this friend. And I just felt him, and I loved him. I loved to talk about him, because every time I talked about him, I felt this embrace from him. I felt loved. It's incredible. And I lost that. It was around adolescence when I started to lose it. And Jesus became a source of bitterness to me. And that bitterness grew into this insatiable appetite to know the truth about, did historical Jesus even exist?
Yeah. Right.
Okay, and if he did, like, what was he actually about? What did he actually teach? Did he say all that stuff in the Bible? And that, I just read books on the historical Jesus for a good decade. I think it was a good 10 years where I was just a man obsessed.
Totally deconstructed Jesus.
Yeah, well, not deconstructed yet. Certainly, I tried to rationalize Jesus. I wanted to make sense of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then after I kind of wore that out, this was when I was in Europe. Mm. You know, I moved to Spain, and I found myself just drifting into the cathedrals, just these towering beauties, this stonework, stained glass, hundreds of years old. And
this is after being in China for how long?
I was in China for a year.
Okay.
Came back. I got my degree in the States.
Yeah.
Went to Spain.
If you want to flee Jesus, China would be a good place to do that.
It was.
And then you go to Spain.
Jesus, they will not stamp his passport in China.
Yeah.
No way. I'm in Spain, and I'm just drifting into these cathedrals, and I'm just sitting in these meditation halls, which it's essentially what these cathedrals were over the centuries. And I was feeling something again. And I knew about all the biblical hermeneutics, and I knew that there were like problematic interpretations with, did that person really write that book? And, you know, did Jesus walk on water? There were, you know, there's controversy around it. And like sitting in those cathedrals just didn't matter anymore. I was like that kid again. I'm reminded of Paul Ricoeur, who calls this the second naivete, where I returned to something that was elemental, something I didn't need to rationalize. It didn't have to make sense. I just felt it. Like you said in our previous visit, that there's no substitute for just sitting across from somebody and connecting with them and feeling their experience and even merging with them. I felt like I was merging with Jesus again. And it was like just the most amazing experience to know that this precious presence and this friend in my life that had informed me so deeply when I was young, that I didn't have to give that up. Because who wants to give up universal love? You know, Jesus is very much, whatever your personal beliefs are on Jesus, there's no question that on a certain level, Jesus is the symbol of universal love freely given to mankind.
Mm-hmm.
And that was back in me again. So this is amazing. Like, I mean, it was really a reawakening for me in Europe. And, you know, years later, I'm learning about development, and there's a very clear sequence that we look at in development: pre-rational, rational, post-rational, right? Yeah. My pre-rational phase, where I didn't have to make sense of Jesus. That was just, he's my buddy. Yeah. I love him. You know, a five-year-old doesn't need to make sense of Jesus, doesn't need to historicize him. But the 15-year-old me did need to historicize him. I was deeply disturbed by the history. And so there's this dryness in that rational period.
You're deeply disturbed by the fact that the stories that had been told about Jesus may or may not have been reliable,
the
or
fact,
as reliable,
yeah,
as you
totally
thought they
the
were.
The facts did not add up.
Yeah. So,
and then finally, in that progression, you know, so the rational phase, I felt vindicated. I felt like I was being honest with myself and responsible. So it had its own energy. I was getting some juice out of that relationship to Jesus, but I missed my friend.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, coming back into that relationship post-rational, it means that I knew how to be rational. Mm-hmm. I had developed those faculties, and yet there was something beyond the thinking mind, something totally beyond reason that was just direct felt experience.
Yeah.
And it was the most powerful thing I'd felt.
No matter what anybody said about Jesus in the scripture or another, like there was a relationship there that was real, that survived whatever deconstruction may have happened.
Right. And that's why I often tell people, that people ask me what I believe, and I often say something around the theme, something along the lines of, I don't care what I believe. I don't care what you believe.
Mm-hmm.
I do care what I believe and what you believe, but what I care about even more than belief is that experience where, to me, this is the rock. This is my own interpretation. When we talk about building your testimony on the rock of Christ, it's beyond any human argument. It's beyond any fact, past, present, or future, that will be discovered about the historical Jesus. It's something so true and so universal that there is nothing that can dislodge you from that.
And you managed to preserve through your, even during your time of alienation from your Christian faith, you managed to preserve that connection somehow with God, though you might have named it differently. Mm. You might have said, I'm post-Christian, or I don't know what you considered yourself then, but is that true? Like, there was something that was kept alive. There were some roots that were kept alive through this contemplative practice, through this meditation practice.
Right? For sure. I mean, for years, I would not have related to the word God at all, and now I don't care.
I'm talking about God.
Call it God. That's fine. but yeah, for years, I was in a practice that was non-theistic. Yeah. Buddhism is not theistic, nor is it atheistic. It's just non-theistic. It takes no, you know, real stance. Well, that depends on the school of Buddhism. But I was in that school where I didn't care. I wasn't worried about what God meant. I was just in the practice of it. And the question was always, what am I experiencing?
Yeah. I love that, too, that you brought in that second naivete. I've experienced this kind of same thing. It probably took me longer in my life to really come back to this. But so I'm going to push back just a little bit on what you said.
I love when people do that.
No, I know you do.
It's when I'm at my best.
Because you're going to Kung Fu Panda me right now. there's something very specific and concrete about Christianity and about Mormonism that you, like, when you come back to Mormonism, you come back to something that's very particular and very concrete in a lot of ways. If you look at Christianity, you've got Jesus who grew up in this gritty little village in poverty, the son of what was considered to be a birth out of wedlock. And you've got a story of him, you know, for at least what we know of his adult life, homeless. So a gritty existence. You get iron spikes being driven through the flesh and into wood. I mean, it's very concrete. There's there's nothing, it's not just mystical. It's not just this, know, universal love. It's also this particular experience. And so, that's fundamental to Christianity, is like this particularity. And then and then Paul, of course, who really was responsible for Christianity becoming Christianity. There's no way to explain Paul unless you understand that he saw a resurrected Christ. And then what does Mormonism lay on top of that? But a prophet with very concrete, with metal plates and stones, and we have, lead bullets piercing his flesh, and he hits the ground with a thud, and we've got hand carts and mountains, and then we got carving big pieces of block out of a granite mountain and making a temple out of it. Yeah. And then in a very particular way, we form these communities, like these communities of practice. They're, real people that we kind of have to associate with. There are given facts of life in a community in which we practice. And so there's, and we minister to each other in really concrete ways. When we minister to each other in ordinances, we reach out and touch each other. Like, there's nothing that's separated from the, there's something that's really elemental, fundamental to our religion about the particularity and the concreteness of it. There's a ethereal quality to sometimes to the way you speak and the way the contemplatives often speak that doesn't seem to, in some way, doesn't seem to connect or, with that very concrete aspect.
I mean, I would be curious. The first thing that comes to mind is a specific instance of a speech I'm using that feels ethereal and excarnated. That's interesting to me.
I don't think you are excarnated. At some point, Jesus becomes almost like metaphor.
So, I mean, first and foremost, to me, Christianity is a tradition of God made flesh. It's absolutely concrete. This idea that there has to be a leaving and there has to be a returning, it's a growing up process. It's a developmental process. So for me, I mean, absolutely, I've been influenced by the contemplative traditions, and I maybe more than others, I tend to speak in terms of transcendent terms. But really, the fruition of transcendence is always immanence. So in my own personal relationship with Jesus, if I can put it that way, you know, before I took up the path of contemplation, Jesus was just Jesus.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, Jesus was no longer Jesus. It was a principle. It was a metaphor. It was pointing
to abstraction.
Right. Mm-hmm. And to me now, as plain as day, Jesus is Jesus. To me, the whole point is that a person did this.
Yeah.
And if a person didn't do this, then we can't do it. But if somebody who we call Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus the Nazarite, if he did it, then it says something about our deepest humanity and our highest potential. So it's absolutely a transcendent current and principle of godliness that's grounded and immanent in a being, in a human being, flesh and blood, like ourselves.
Yeah, so you're saying on the other side of this is a Jesus that's actually more real in some ways.
Oh, no question.
Because I can say, I think in our youth, Jesus is who we want him to be.
For sure.
And I've experienced this relatively recently coming back. So I have to say, in my own personal, the most profound spiritual experiences when I really connected profoundly with God, it was in the context of very specific Christian practice. At age 18, I think I shared this story, but just fasting, praying, and then taking the sacrament. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of Sam Brown. Sam Brown's experience, like Sam was an atheist at age 14. And then at age 18, I believe, kind of decided that's getting me nowhere, my life's going off the rails, comes back. And it was in the blessing of the sacrament, after he'd been sort of requalified to bless the sacrament, that he experienced this. Sam is the most brilliant person I know. Mm. And present company excluded, of course, but he's he said from that point on, that was such a direct experience with God that I, believing or not believing was no longer an option. I knew God existed. Yeah. So that was my experience as well. And it was in a very specific, you know, the emblems of the sacrament being passed, and that happened to me. So I've had also connection with God through contemplative practice, but in those, like my earliest experience were in that very specific Christian context.
Yeah.
And so after going through a period of some deconstruction, not total deconstruction, but sorting out like what's baggage and what's not, what nourishes me, interestingly, is contemplating Christ, contemplating Jesus's life. I feel like Jesus is much more real to me than he was when I was young. And carried over from my early experiences was that connection. That connection has been redefined in my mind, but somehow I've returned a little later in life to Jesus as just fundamental, that fundamental rock of my faith. So prayer.
Prayer, this is another. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We can take any topic in the gospel or otherwise and consider it from a developmental perspective. How did I relate to it when I was 5 years old? How did I relate to it when I was 20 years old? How will I relate to it when I'm 70 years old? Prayer, again, not so different than Jesus. Prayer is like, you know, I remember having a prayer rock that I got in primary and put it on my pillow so that it's...
I didn't get one of those.
You didn't get a prayer rock?
No,
you put it on your pillow so that it's uncomfortable. You lie down, it's hard. You're like, oh, yeah, I need to pray.
It reminds
you to pray. It's just like, you know, speaking of a concrete practice, like I got a rock that reminds me to pray.
Yeah, no, I had monsters under my bed that did that for me.
Yeah, right. So I prayed. I prayed as a kid. I loved to pray. I just remember how I felt when I was a kid. When I said a prayer, I knew somebody was listening to me. I felt that someone was listening to me. And then nobody was listening, right? And when I lost that, I lost my religion. God didn't make sense anymore. Rationally, it made way more sense that there is no God. And I never, identified as an atheist, but I think in practice I was a functioning atheist. There was just nothing like God in my world for a long time. I guess I was not committed enough to pick up the title. So I didn't pray a lick for, I don't know, I guess it would have been 5 years or so.
So what were you connecting with when you were in your meditative practice? You're connecting with something deep.
I turned 18. I remember I was really struck. I guess it's similar to your experience taking the sacrament, Sam Brown's blessing the sacrament. I remember just having an intention to meditate for the first time. I was 18. I was driven to it by my own suffering, which is often how we're brought to a meditation path.
Right.
I just sat on the floor, closed my eyes, and it was kind of beginner's luck. You know, when you don't know what you're doing, you don't know what you're supposed to feel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my first experience meditating was actually much more deeper and richer than maybe the next 10 years of meditating in some ways, because you're trying to chase that first experience and then you realize you're not supposed to chase experience. But that's another story. I sat down, I closed my eyes, and I was completely struck. I was shocked. I couldn't believe what I was feeling, but I was absolutely sensing into eternity. I could feel the eternity.
And you didn't need to call that God. It was just like this very deep reality that you could just feel.
It felt like God.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, I think what was shocking about that moment is all of a sudden 5 years where like I kind of blew the dust off of that term. I'm like, oh, this is actually useful again, because I don't know what else to call that. But I felt very intimate with and one with this eternity just, you know, expanding out in every direction. And I just knew I plugged into something in that stillness, and I, you know, I've done it every day the rest of my life since then. So prayer was happening again. And then, you know, after years and years of meditation, I caught on to the fact that there's actually something powerful in Buddhism. In Buddhist meditation, you sit as the ultimate identity. So it's this I am experience. Mm. And that's very rich and profound. And I think the Eastern traditions have a lot to teach us about the I am kind of experience and consciousness. But what Christianity does particularly well, which I've come to appreciate more and more, is that there's also something about the I-thou relationship, about coming into relationship with the ultimate. Yeah. It's different to worship and adore God than to be God. And we all know we have access to both of those dimensions and more, that I can be one with everything, and I can also worship the infinitely mysterious and loving divine. And that's a totally different experience. And my experience is that both modalities really grow us and nourish us in different ways, and we can do both.
Mm.
Buddhism tends to foreground that I am experience.
Basically,
Christianity,
recognizing your permanent nature as divine.
Yeah, Christianity, we would call it the divine indwelling.
Yeah.
It would be the Christian mystical term for it. But you don't hear divine indwelling at a Mormon sacrament reading all that much.
No.
But it is there, and we have the capacity to be it. But you hear a lot more about let us pray. Let's commune.
It's good that you had the experience in your youth of connecting deeply in prayer. I didn't.
Oh, okay.
To me, prayer was strictly a petitionary, God is a vending machine kind of.
Me too.
It was formulaic. And I'm sure you had. Yeah.
Sure.
But it's. I didn't feel a deep connection. Mm. The first time I felt a deep connection with God was, you know, after fasting and prayer and in that one experience, and then that opened a whole new. Like relationship that opened my relationship to God. But before that, so you know, petitionary prayer, which is that's a name for kind of how we pray. Actually, that's how we're taught to pray. Mm-hmm. We address God. We don't sit as I am presence and feel identity with God. We address God as a separate being with whom we would like to have relationship. Right? And we thank, and then we ask, and then we close. And it's a mediated relationship, presumably through Christ. Mm-hmm. And if we're in church and we talk about prayer, that's what we're talking about.
Yep.
This petitionary prayer relationship.
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
There's another way to pray that's perhaps more Eastern that you learn through meditation.
Mm.
That there's also a rich Christian contemplative prayer or centering prayer tradition.
The prayer of quiet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because God can only be experienced in the present.
Yeah.
He experiences, God experiences everything in the presence, and we can only experience God's presence in the present.
Yeah.
So then when we try to put words on things, we're first of all taking it out of that direct relationship.
Right.
And making language be our mediator.
That's right.
And and then we're also, as soon as we start talking, we're thinking about constructs that involve past and future, right. And so would you agree that we need to find space for both of those kinds of prayer?
Yeah. And
because I think you have, or I guess you have, I don't know. Do you still do petitionary prayer?
This goes back to our prior discussion about concreteness, the concreteness of Mormonism, the incarnation of Christ and the God made flesh. I'm reminded in the moment of Father Thomas Keating's work. You know, he's restored contemplation in the 20th century to the Christian church.
Might we recommend a book for the listener?
Oh, Open Mind, Open Heart.
I've got that in my backpack.
Seminal
right now.
Work. It's just a gorgeous book.
Yeah, I love it.
His language, Keating talks about the practice of consenting to God's presence, the presence and action of God, which is too subtle for any human faculty to perceive. Mm. So there's that level of, we can't put language to it. We can't even experience God. God is so subtle at the ultimate level. And then, and after we move into this infinitely rich and beatific abyss of divine presence, then we come back up and we petition. We incarnate our own intentions in the world with a thought, with a prayer, with a please help me be a better husband.
Yeah.
Help me be a better servant. So to me, prayer is totally incomplete without that dissolution into radical divine presence, and then the coming back up into, this is what I want to do in the world. I want to build something. I want to become something. Yeah. They're always hand in hand.
And that comes out of, but that needs to emerge from that stillness, and we need to make space for that stillness.
That's a lost art for us.
It is, and I think I've told you this, but just very recently, again, my state president, who in some ways is a very conventional Mormon, right?
Sure, sure.
And has a lot of the same. But he challenged us in that same meeting that I spoke about. At the end of the meeting, he brought the meeting to a close and said, we're going to sing a closing prayer, and then we're going to, or sing a closing hymn and prayer, but then we're going to, I want to challenge you to just remain in your seats and be still and see, just, be completely still.
Mm-hmm.
Try to let your thoughts not carry you away, but try to feel in the moment God's presence, and then what you need to do. And we sat there for, as a congregation, 500-600 people, for 5 minutes in stillness. You don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
That never happens other than in the sacrament,
right.
Which is everyone's favorite part of the meeting of the Mormon meetings, right? That stillness. And he said, when you're done, you can get up, you can make your way to the door, but before you do, think about who you're going to reach out to and what God wants you to. So we literally saw 500 or 600 people do this.
Mm-hmm.
Just an experience to see what emerged from that stillness. And it was amazing for me, I know, and I've talked to other people that, and they say, oh yeah, something beautiful emerged from that.
Right.
So we can do that.
Right.
We can do that that goes back to the way we gather. Why don't we have more stillness? Yeah.
Exactly.